Call to order the House, I'm sorry, excuse me, Judiciary Committee. Don't wolf down your watch. At 5 minutes after one, members present are Bundy, James, Green, and Porter. We do have a quorum. Excuse me. This afternoon we'll continue testimony for House Bill 406, and we have three people who have indicated so far, at least, that they would like to testify. Anyone else? We have a listen-only teleconference, but any of you in the audience who also want to testify, please feel free to. First person that has signed up is Rod Arno. Would you please identify yourself, Rod, and your affiliation?
Okay, I got a couple handouts
here. All right.
Yes, my name is Rod Arno. I'm president of the Alaska Outdoor Council, which is a statewide organization. We represent approximately 10,000 Alaskans. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the opportunity to testify. I appreciate the position that you're in trying to stop a federal takeover of game management. It's a hoax for the public to pretend that Alaska will secure any kind of permanent authority to manage fish and wildlife on federal public lands in Alaska by amending the Alaska Constitution to permit discrimination among Alaska residents. An amendment providing a rural preference to public assets, fish and game resources, will give Alaska limited authority to manage fish and wildlife within federally specified guidelines. But that authority will at all times remain revocable by Congress and subject to decisions of federal courts. Only a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court will regain state subsistence management of fish and game. Title 8 of ANILCA is a flawed law. First, it's not in the best interest of conservation. I mean, the idea that to move on to wildlife habitat and get a priority to live off the land is contrary to wildlife conservation. Biological risk data tabulated by the Department of Fish and Game are these two volumes right here. Let me just read to you one example. And this example has to do with Dall sheep. In a number of game management, this is game management 24, and it says confusion, biological risk, and decreased subsistence opportunity. It says the great difference between state and federal bag limits begs explanation. The 9-month season for a bag limit of 3 sheep in Gates of the Arctic National Park is the most liberal of the North American continent. This regulation infers that sheep are either hyperabundant or in need of population reduction. Neither is the case. Sheep populations throughout the Brooks Range have declined notably since the 90s and are at modern historic lows. This federal subsistence hunt carries a high probability of further reducing sheep populations in the area. This is just one of many examples of conservation concerns. Two is that there's an increase in the request for reconsideration on federal subsistence regulations put in by the Department of Fish and Game. And each year that the Federal Subsistence Board has operated, these reconsiderations have increased. Under ANILCA as it is now, under ANILCA as it's been amended by Stevens, there's nothing that will substantially change the way that the federal government is managing the game side of fish and game. Second, Title 8 of ANILCA causes divisiveness and discrimination among people who share similar interests. Title 8 of ANILCA in the findings says that native, cultural existence, non-native, social existence, needs to be preserved in their relationship to harvest of wild game. Right now, in rural areas of Alaska, over 54% are non-native. In the urban area just of Anchorage, 20% of the native population of the entire state lives in Anchorage. And if Congress has decided that if you're a native in a rural area, you have cultural existence, and if you're non-native, the best you can have is social existence, then what do the natives that live in the urban area have as an existence in regard to wildlife harvest? And again, requests for reconsideration of federal subsistence regulations shows clearly the discrimination. Here's an example of one. This is up in Anwar, the refuge, Red Sheep, Cane Creek drainage is where they've excluded non-local rural residents. And the state has said the state's legitimate interest in continued opportunities for a diversity of uses of resident wildlife is unnecessarily restricted by this regulation. Finally, this regulation impairs on the state's ability to fulfill its obligations under the public trust doctrine. And again, these are all submitted by the Department of Fish and Game. Of all the House committees, the Judiciary should understand best that substantial changes to Title VIII of ANILCA must be negotiated to assure sound conservation of natural resources and to put an end to the divisiveness among Alaska's people. Thank you for allowing the concerns of the Outdoor Council's members to be heard. We hope to have the opportunity to help you craft a workable solution to Alaska's subsistence management issue. Thank you.
Rod, you talking about the ANILCA that we have, even with the Stevens Amendments, did I hear in your testimony that your position on what we might be doing to change the way we administer our in-state area, if we get certain changes to ANILCA, would that have a direct bearing on the Outdoor Council's attitude?
As far as on state lands?
Well,
is that, or the
and federal.
Absolutely. The Outdoor Council, from the first of this, has been concerned with the flawed public law in Title VIII of ANILCA. And that no matter what changes we make to conform to that law, if we can't make the substantial changes that are necessary for the concerns that we have, then that's the impasse.
Thank you. Representative Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rod, on these appeals of the Federal Subsistence Board, or by Fish and Game to the Federal Subsistence Board, do you have a number of that were granted or overturned or upheld?
I don't have that number. The ones that I have quoted to you are areas that I hunt in and I've followed personally, and in none of those have they been overturned.
And so the 9-month sheep season still exists.
Correct.
And another question, if I might. You know, one of the concerns I think many of us share is, as you've mentioned several times, the divisiveness. I can see we can please one side or we can please the other. I have a very difficult time seeing how to please both. Can you give me an idea how fighting for the urban majority would reduce the divisiveness? Because is there anything in your crystal ball that would reduce the anxiety in rural Alaska?
Chairman. Representative Bundy. That as a guide outfitter that spent 33 years on public lands in these rural areas, the only time that I see a conflict is when I come to town. That the conflict doesn't seem to exist on the land where the hunting activity is occurring. As far as what we could do to reach a consensus and assure rural people, native particularly, that their interest would and concerns would be legitimized to where they wouldn't have to feel that, I think by looking at a broader spectrum of time, that, you know, we are concerned with today and not looking to population increases that we're seeing in rural areas. And as those things became clearer to people now in rural areas, the realization that all you have to do is move on to that land base and you qualify, that they would feel and see in time such increase in use that their opportunities would diminish respectively to that. The way you do that to not have that happen is to have bag limit seasons. You manage wildlife as the state did prior to Anelka, and you manage for abundance. And the only way that I think we'll get past the divisiveness is realizing that a unified management under the state that is allowed to manage for abundance, unlike the federal mandate is today, that, you know, we can then go ahead and have that resource available on a regulated basis.
Representative Berkowitz, and for the record, Representatives Berkowitz and Croft joined us shortly after we started.
Rod, I'm sorry I missed the beginning of your presentation. I just want to be clear, you're here testifying in support of 406? I asked, because I missed the beginning. Okay. You and I have spoken about this subject before, and I asked you a question then, and you said you'd get back to me, and I was hoping you had a chance to look into it. And it was in the context of the limited entry permits, you indicated that you felt that kind of discrimination was acceptable because people had the opportunity to buy a limited entry permit. And I raised the question, don't people have an opportunity to move rural? And you're going to explore what the difference was and if the Outdoor Council had a position on that distinction.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Rod.
Representative Berkowitz. Conservation is the difference. It's not in the best interest of conservation, and that's the number one concern to the Alaska Outdoor Council. And for people to be able to continually move on to wilderness habitat and to wildlife habitat and then gain an opportunistic live off the land privilege to that is not in the best interest of conservation, unlike the limited entry that was in the best interest of conservation.
Hello, Representative Berkowitz.
Well, though we were discussing this in the context of equal protection. And you found that the limited entry was an acceptable within the context of equal protection because someone had an opportunity to purchase a limited entry permit. And I suggested that an argument I had heard was that people had an opportunity to move rural, and therefore, which would somewhat be analogous as far as equal protection is concerned.
Mr. Chairman, a priority based on your zip code, there's the difference.
We want to avoid a debate here.
Well, I'm not trying to debate here, but I just want to be clear that you are not basing an objection to a rural preference on an equal protection argument merely on a conservation argument.
No, Mr. Chairman. That it's discriminatory based solely on where you live. That is discrimination.
Let me pull the thread a little more here because I'm not sure I understand this distinction. There is discrimination as far as me being able to fish. I don't possess a limited entry permit. That's a discrimination. Is that fair to say?
No.
I can buy one.
You can buy one.
So that's not discriminatory. Can I not move rural?
Yes, you can.
Okay. And would that same question of being able to get around discrimination not apply in this context?
Mr. Chairman, no.
And could you explain the distinction again?
Representative Berkowitz, your ability to purchase something is not discrimination. Just choose, if you so choose to work hard enough to get the money, borrow the money, you can buy it. You agree with that. That is not discriminatory. You have the opportunity to purchase. But to have a real preference to the harvest of fish and game resources that are a public asset on public lands, you need to physically move and get a zip code in an area designated rural. And that's the difference.
To maybe put an end to this, as I understand the discussion is going, that if you live anywhere in the state, you can buy a limited entry permit, but you can't live any place in the state and get a priority under a subsistence. And I think that's what he's saying is the difference.
But you can buy a house in rural Alaska.
That's true.
From anywhere in the state.
But I think what he's saying is that by doing that, you are set apart from those who live within the city, as opposed to you can live anywhere, in city or out of city, and still buy a limited entry permit. But I think we've discussed that probably enough. Representative Porter.
Aren't there a limited number of limited entry permits? Rod, what in your opinion would be the best relationship we could end up with the feds in relation to state management versus some degree of federal oversight?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Porter, with constructive changes to Title 8 of ANILCA, I think that working from that base, I think we could easily, in statute, come up with a program that would indeed do exactly what the intent of ANILCA was, and that was to provide that resource to people who depended on it and people who had traditionally used it. And so, you know, the crux of it is that the things that are preventing us from doing that are federal management as they have actively stepped in. That we feel, the Outdoor Council and numerous other people, that the judicial enforcement has been overstepped with the administrative enforcement, and that by stopping that process, this process, is how that we could go ahead and manage, you know, the resource to accommodate rural subsistence users. And I think that as we did prior to ANILCA, that the Department of Fish and Game through the boards in a short little time frame where it was quite a transition from no regulations to asking to be regulated, well, over the next 20 to 50 years of making that process, I think that it could be workable.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm going to step out on a limb and say that I would guess that if we are able to put out anything, that it will certainly have the caveat that whatever we do is null and void if this lawsuit should be won that would answer all of those questions. But setting the lawsuit aside, from a political solution, would it be acceptable, if that were the only remaining alternative, from your point of view, to have basically within ANILCA and our own statutes the agreement that the state would manage fish and game within the state on federal land, and that there would be a deference to our management, not, I guess, anything further than that, recognizing that, and there isn't total agreement on this, but I think more folks than not believe that the property clause does leave some residual federal oversight that we're never going to get rid of. Would what I've generally described there be generally acceptable?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Porter. You know, the history of trying to get changes to ANILCA, you're well aware of what hoops that we've jumped through and where we have been stopped repeatedly trying to go through the judicial system on that. That the breach of faith is, that it is such a wide gap, and particularly with the public law that Senator Stevens got in this last November, that for us to go back and say, okay, we're going to, in good faith, make an agreement that we'll capitulate with the hopes that you'll change in the future. You know, I don't have that faith personally, and as I see here in the findings that Stevens got in, you know, the whole argument of the WHO case, the state of Alaska versus Babbitt, that in the findings 801B4 is Stevens has got, in accordance with Title 8 of this act, the Secretary of Interior is required to manage fish and wildlife for subsistence uses on all public lands in Alaska because of the state's failure to provide a law for rural preference. Well, this is the whole argument, and I believe that once the state of Alaska had made a compromise that the voters agreed on and accepted this, that we would have less of a standing on the judicial side because they go, look, you've already, you know, passed this through. That's one piece. The second piece is as we have seen and was written by Judge Holland, there were a number of reasons why the Alaska District Court did not pursue moving the McDowell 3, the Olson, through the courts. And Judge Holland specifically says the reason for that is because of the hope that this would be taken care of through legislation. So that, you know, once we make the capitulate and say, okay, you know, we'll do it your way, I think that in order to get standing would be much harder, and that our argument would be weakened by the amendments here.
Just one comment, and then we'll let the other folks ask questions, but I'll go way out on a limb again and say I don't think anything that would come out of here would not have a proviso that provision you just read came out of an ilk.
Unless they skin me. Not so far out. Okay, we have Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rod, you spent a lot of time out in the rural areas, I understand, and so you kind of understand what happens out there. And the court has indicated, and also Senator Murkowski has indicated, that we could define that need without a constitutional amendment. Do you think that there's a possibility of doing that without creating it as a welfare system or a huge administrative chore? Is there a simple way that we could define that need in rural Alaska and put it into the statutes without a constitutional amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, yes, absolutely. And you know, that there are a number of people that I've been fortunate to work with on this in my capacity in the Outdoor Council that have spent years working with management for the state and that have the knowledge and the expertise to go ahead. Hopefully you'll have a chance to talk with them on that. But
thank you, Mr. Chairman. One follow-up question. Would you believe or would you agree that whatever we pass statutorily should provide a framework and that the implementation ought to be determined by the Boards of Fish and Game?
What? Representative James, yes. And that's, you know, there again, I think that that's something that the state is set up to handle quite well and could do a more than adequate job given that opportunity without the constraints that we've been having to deal with, or as I've seen the department try to deal with on what happened under the Federal Subsistence Board regime.
One more, Mr. Chairman, and that is that do you believe, with your experience working with and observing Alaska State Fish and Game, that if Alaska State Fish and Game were in charge of this issue totally, that both non-native and native subsistence users and non-subsistence users would all be winners?
Absolutely. Yes, they would.
Thank you.
Representative Croft.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rod, a couple of questions. What is the Outdoor Council's solution to this? What are you proposing? If it's not 406, what is the solution?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft, that to date we have not drafted a complete solution of our own, that we have voiced our concerns that the solution would have to contain numerous changes to the flawed law of Anelka, and then we could proceed. That other members of the Outdoor Council will be testifying that could give you some of those specifics. That at this point, you know, as we look back and the Outdoor Council's position on Governor Hickel's subsistence group, that we believe, and you know, I've been told this by numerous other people, including Jay Hammond, who was on that task force, that may have been the closest to a real workable solution that we would be able to come up with because of continued public pressure. But I think that you know, that is a piece to look at that allowed for the intent, as I see Anelka, to be implemented.
Well, I should know by this time in the debate, but what were the major, if that's what you think is the core of a solution, what were the major components of it? How does it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft. What that did is it had where villages, small towns with a population of less than 2,500, everyone in there automatically then qualified for subsistence. So then there was varying degrees as the the population of the town increased, that you had to then go to a system where those within that town would have to meet certain requirements. And as you got to larger populated areas, then they would have more stringent requirements that they would have to meet in order to qualify for that priority use.
If somebody living in a town under 2,500 automatically qualifies, isn't that back to discrimination by zip code?
Mr. Chairman, as I stated earlier, that the problem is the flaw in Title VIII of Anelka, and you continually are asking me, you know, what kind of a hoop could we jump through to make small changes that would make a flawed law work?
I haven't asked you but two questions.
Okay, all right, but okay, well then, but and both got to the same thing about, you know, what scheme do we have that would make a flawed law work? And we don't have a scheme that'll make a flawed law work.
Well, I don't want you to make a flawed law work. Let's just set aside the political realities that we all are facing here or in Congress, and just talk about what the perfect management system would be for Alaska. I mean, I'm just curious what we've seen various different proposals, what the Outdoor Council thinks is the appropriate preference for subsistence uses.
Chairman Green, Representative Croft. That the for conservation's sake and to eliminate discrimination, the best example that we have is a system that has been put together under democracy, that everyone is considered to be equal, and that we manage for conservation on a system that encompasses both federal and state lands, and that is the, you know, would be the best policy. That as soon as you start trying to legitimize a priority, then you're dealing about working around flaws. So if you ask what would be, you know, the best, it would be then just what we will need in the next millennium to provide for conservation, and that is a unified system and access determined on ag limits, seasons.
But one where
Representative Croft, follow up.
Too engaged in the dialogue, but it would not have any component of local people having a preference over people outside the location. It would be, as you said, unitary.
Representative Croft, that, you know, that I've got a note here from Dick saying that, you know, in the Hickel version, that there was the same standard of lifestyle. So the lifestyle was the same wherever you lived, so that that would allow then people in rural areas and urban areas who lived a subsistence lifestyle then to have a priority.
Well, one other line, and then I'll think about that and see if I have any more. The, as I understood your testimony here, you were wanted to avoid federal court oversight over subsistence on federal land. And I've not been able to find, wonder whether you are able to point me to anywhere where the federal government has said we're going to give up federal court oversight over federal lands.
Chairman, Representative Croft. What we oppose is administrative oversight. And that's what Judge Holland gave the Department of Interior with the fill the gap authority. That when you look at the two cases that went through the courts prior to his takeover, the judicial oversight, if judicial oversight followed an ANILCA that was livable, there wouldn't be any problem. I mean, to have to ask the federal government not to give judicial oversight, you know, isn't the direction, you know, we're forced into that position, but that isn't the direction we need to go at all. All we need is a public law that is reasonable to administer by this state, and if those concerns then fell out, there wouldn't be the problem with the judicial oversight. But all of this is administrative oversight.
You don't know any place where that's happened?
No.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Berkowitz.
Thank you very much. The Hickel plan that you were talking about with Representative Croft, I live in Anchorage. Apparently under the Hickel plan, I wouldn't qualify for subsistence based on my lifestyle. If I were to move to a community of less than 2,500 people, I would qualify?
That, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Roberts, that Dick Bishop will be testifying, and since he was on that panel, it'd be more appropriate to ask him those questions.
That was just one of a list of things. So Okay. You wouldn't qualify, but not because you weren't in a small town.
All right, well, then let me go to what I was going to discuss initially. You clearly don't like the consequences of federal management. Is that fair to say? Do you believe it's necessary to enact a constitutional amendment to protect state management of fish and game?
Chairman, a constitutional amendment will not assure state management of fish and game.
That's not what I asked. Do you believe it's necessary to enact a constitutional amendment in order to ensure management over fish and game?
I don't understand the question.
Well, we have a number of options here. We could do nothing. We could attempt a statutory fix. We could do a constitutional amendment. Now, whatever we do has to, in some way, comply with the wishes of the federal government insofar as ANILCA is concerned. I was saying, doing nothing clearly is not going to get us by ANILCA. I'm asking you, do you think if we have an appropriately worded constitutional amendment, we can get through ANILCA and maintain state management?
Mr. Chairman,
right.
No.
And you feel that, if I can continue, you feel that we have, in essence, made some sort of deal with the federal government where we're in charge of fish and game.
The question was, do I feel like we made a deal with the federal government where the state was in charge? Sure.
And that a deal's a deal.
not necessarily. I think, as I you know, stated in my testimony earlier, that no.
Well, and the reason I ask is because.
Hello, Representative Berkowitz.
Thank you. I'm looking at the ANCSA conference report, where it seems pretty clear to me the federal government indicated that they were going to protect Native subsistence. And it seems to me that that's a deal as well. And it might not be a deal that everyone likes, but a deal is a deal. And if it's a deal that benefits us, or if it's a deal that we're required to carry out, it's still something we have to do.
If it means the concerns to conservation that we're seeing by carrying that out, if it means discrimination and you want to stick with that deal, that's fine. I think what we're here testifying and saying that we would like to change the parameters that we're having to make that deal under.
Briefly, then we've got some other people.
And I understand that you don't like Anoka, but Anoka is the law of the land. But there's been nothing to prevent you from coming forward with an alternative solution. And I'd be happy to entertain it if you could produce it.
Right. Okay, Representative Bundy.
Thank you. Just to get to outdoor life. Revisiting my misspent childhood reading magazines with a flashlight under the covers.
Too much information now.
There was information overload, yeah.
Outdoor culture confession.
Position. Yeah, it was outdoor life, not. Well, then I don't think they had Playboy back then, or maybe it was on clay tablets, I'm not sure. But outdoor council's position on the sale of subsistence caught fishing game. It's a particularly difficult concept for me to deal with. As I understand, Title VIII would allow, or at least some court decisions would allow, a sale of $15,000 or $17,000 worth of fish, or this kind of seafood at this point. I'm concerned that it would then, through other court settlements, broaden out to game. Conceivably selling whale meat, you know, commercial whaling in Alaska. I'm
marine
very
mammals, the Marine Mammal Protection Act.
anyway.
Well, we need to talk about belugas in Anchorage, but in any case, I'm very concerned about that we would actually regress to the 18th century and market hunting again. Is my view incorrect? And if it is, please get me straight. And what is the Outdoors Council's view on this? Then I have a question.
Representative Bundy. Yes, the Outdoor Council is concerned that there is then this definition, the state definition, improved on that we can, you know, that is not the lifestyle I think that NELC is really asking us to ensure. And along with that was our concern in the Knowles Task Force on the proxy hunting, that would essentially do that same thing, where if someone had the advantage of hunting more than, you know, and they were so inclined, that it would be closer to market hunting than what has been available under the laws in the past in that respect.
Oh, it may be then. I'd certainly accept your willingness to defer. Several people mentioned the Marine Mammals Act here. I know currently people in the Anchorage area shoot beluga whales on shares. They take a contribution for the gas and oil to run their boat, and then share the meat, which to me sounds like selling. But do you or the council know that shooting a beluga whale and then just selling $15,000 worth of that would be specifically prohibited by the Marine Mammals Act?
Sure. No, I don't. I don't know.
And on a different topic. Again, I get hung up on semantics a lot of time. To me, subsistence says it's required or you die. And with that in mind, I don't think any subsistence lives or exists in Alaska because, as a state, and much to our credit, we simply wouldn't allow someone to starve to death if we knew of them to be in dire straits and needing food. I've preferred to describe the activity that is called subsistence, either supplemental or personal use, Outdoor Council's position.
To date, we have the Outdoor Council as not opposed to subsistence, that we agree with RuralCap that it's a basic human right. Now, the definition of subsistence, as I think you and I would agree, is one of where your population, your family, that their well-being or their death depended on the fluctuations in wildlife populations, and that's not the case. We have an artificial base that nobody's going to starve off of it, and it's only going to be increasing population. So, you know, with that point, to say that yes, it is a basic human right to harvest wild food stocks for consumption, you know, we would agree, but there again, on the definition of subsistence, if your population isn't tied into a cycle of decline as the cycle of the resource declines, then, you know, we have a false system, and I'm sure that that's a lot of why we're in the quagmire on subsistence that we are.
Thank you.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Berkowitz brought up something that tweaked my interest, and it had to do with the conference report. Would you agree that the intent of ANILCA was to protect a native subsistence lifestyle?
Mr. Chairman, Representative James, absolutely. I mean, what do you think the chances were that if it was 95% were non-native, that the federal land managers would have encouraged Congress to allow that group of people to have the opportunity to hunt opportunistically on federal public lands? It wouldn't happen.
And just to follow up then, if they would have said, and I've been reading ANILCA lately, if it would say rural native instead of rural native and non-native, would be we here having this problem today?
Chairman, Jay, I can't answer that one.
But it would be, if missed my mind, yes. Mr. Chairman, it would be allowed. The federal government can make Indian law. They can give Indians other things than what the rest of us. And Indian's not a good term because much of the native people in our state are Eskimo or Aleut and not Indian. But so the federal government could do that, and we can't. Isn't that's correct?
Mr. Chairman, to my knowledge, I would agree.
Okay, so we probably wouldn't have the lawsuit in the first place, so we wouldn't be having this problem.
Prior to the Venatide decision, I might put a bar of soap in front of your mouth, but...
I understand.
Representative Croft.
Mr. Chairman, I was interested, Rod, in the discussion you and Representative Bundy were having. If subsistence means required or you die, and... nobody in this state is in that condition now. Nobody's them or their family are directly reliant on getting that gain. There's no subsistence in the state now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft, in just my personal opinion, I would agree.
We're getting somewhat, I guess, into a definition. Under that definition of subsistence, there's no one that qualifies. Should we protect a subsistence lifestyle? I mean, if there's no subsistence defined as required or you die, is there any aspect of the broader idea of subsistence that's worth protecting?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft. Yes, biophilia. Biophilia, and that's... Edward O. Wilson, Pulitzer Prize winning scientist, came up with the term, and the study that in the last 250,000 years of civilization, human development, all of us at one time lived in a hunter-gatherer society. Our minds as humans developed and grew under that. It's a large piece of what we all need. But those people that disassociate themselves from it and move to urban areas become dysfunctional and then have social problems that need to get straightened out.
Can we quote you on that later?
You can make me predatory real quick.
So, seriously, to your answer, yes, it is something that we need to protect, but what we need to do is we need to protect that for all humans. So on a limited basis, for those who aren't living in that habitat to have the opportunity to make that connection, that's extremely important. And for Native people, it's extremely important in my mind that they continue to have that opportunity and that connection for environmental reasons, if nothing else.
Seeing no other questions, then, we certainly appreciate your testimony, Rod, and I hope you didn't feel like you were being cross-examined on the witness stand, what we're really trying to get is as much input as we can and some cross-pollination of ideas, and we sure appreciate yours.
All right. Thank you.
Dick Bishop. Please identify yourself and your association, if you would, Dick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dick Bishop. I live near Fairbanks. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Alaska Outdoor Council, and unless Rod has changed his mind in the last few hours, I guess I'm still serving as a subsistence spokesperson, but I think he's done a pretty good job of doing that. But at any rate, I am still involved in that. I really appreciate the committee's efforts to address this issue, which obviously from your questions and the discussion isn't an easy one to get around, and I'm reassured that this committee does not appear to be dysfunctional at this stage, and I hope that your efforts don't cause you to be. I'd like to point out just a little background that about 25 years ago, I became very concerned in the prospect of ANILCA being formulated and passed, that the opportunity for hunting, fishing, and trapping in general, and for what people characterize, depending on your view, as subsistence, was in dire straits. It was had a distinct possibility of being eliminated from substantial portions of Alaska, because it was very clear extensive national conservation system units in the state, and it was also very clear, and I was involved, as a matter of fact, with that group, that they had absolutely no sympathy for the continuation of the public's opportunity to hunt, fish, trap, and make other uses of natural resources on the public lands. And that if there is any way, they would ensure that those kinds of uses would be prohibited in these substantial areas. I say that with some authority, because the principal coalition of organizations advocating that viewpoint, and whose first demand on Congress in the passage of ANILCA was that all the conservation system unit lands be classified instantly as wilderness. That coalition was called the Alaska Coalition, and to my everlasting embarrassment, I chaired the first session of that coalition, which consisted of roughly 8 people in Fairbanks, with representatives from the Wilderness Society, the Sierra Club, Audubon Society, the Alaska Conservation Society, and so on. So you may not consider any of the rest of my testimony credible. However, I would like to continue.
Please do.
But it was very clear from the outset that I learned a lot about politics in that context, that those organizations were determined to, in the sense of public uses of renewable natural resources, were going to constrain that to the maximum extent possible, with a environmentalist, preservationist policy or dictum in mind. As a result, this gets around to the point where we're here today, I guess, I became very incensed with the need to protect these kinds of opportunities. And in particular, it became apparent to me that subsistence was getting, however you characterize it, and I view it as living off the land in some measure. No one does it completely anymore, that's very true. But that the lifestyle of depending on natural resources for your livelihood, for your lifestyle, was in jeopardy. it became very apparent to me in the context in particular of an area I was very familiar with, which was the north side of Denali National Park. I happened to have been the area biologist in McGrath in 1969, 70, 71, and I had a lot of experience in that area. As a biologist, I was well acquainted with what was going on there. I was very concerned that those kinds of uses would be eliminated by a very expansive, much larger actually than it turned out, proposal for the expansion of Denali National Park. And I was concerned enough that when the opportunity arose to document that, yes, people actually do live there, they actually do hunt, fish, trap as part of their livelihood, etc., I took that opportunity and produced a review of the level and extent and kinds of human uses of natural resources in that area. And fortunately, a similar effort was made in other areas, and one of the results that contributed to the result that there was some provision made for subsistence. As it turned out, there was a great effort by the Alaska Federation of Natives to include some measure of protection in Anilka because they saw the very same risk at hand, and they felt correctly that it would affect their constituents, and there was no question about it. When it really came right down to it, the reason that we have a rural priority in there instead of what preceded it in state law of just an Alaskan priority was that the council and representative for AFN, Don Mitchell, met with representatives from the state and federal government, and I happened to be in on one of those meetings and said, look, we're either going to have rural in this law or we're going to do our best to kill it. And that was a flat statement in a small meeting in Washington, D.C., and I, in spite of my perhaps lack of credibility based on my Alaska Coalition Association, I can tell you that that's a fact, and I was there. So previously, the state law did have in 1978, as you know, a subsistence priority, but no rural provision. And of course, we were told that that was a finely tuned, perfectly balanced piece of legislation that needed absolutely no alteration when it was criticized it. But when it got into the federal arena, which it was not supposed to have to do, then all of a sudden it became imperative to put rural, and boy, did that ever mess things up. So here we are. As it turned out, then I've had to, although I was and continue to be a strong advocate of subsistence lifestyles, I can't, either as personally or as a representative of the Alaska Outdoor Council, for reasons that Rod has enumerated, support the idea of a rural priority subsistence priority. And there are two basic reasons. Rod did mention them. One is sound conservation. The federal law is not adequate in that regard. And the other is discrimination. It's certainly not adequate in that regard. And I would like to address one of your concerns, Representative Berkowitz. If you look in the findings of the McDowell case, when the Alaska Supreme Court found that the rural priority was unconstitutional under our existing constitution, what they said about moving to a rural area was that to require people to do that, I don't remember the exact terms, that exceeded the bounds of or standards of territorial discrimination. To require people to do that, to exercise their rights under the Constitution to try to get food when that had been provided for on the basis of common use and equal protection. So that was the Supreme Court's view of it was that that was going too far to require people to move to rural areas. Let me just comment on a few things, and I think maybe if you have questions, I hope I can help you out. But I was really pleased to hear that folks in that advocate the rural priority felt that it was really basically important opportunity to be able to harvest fish and game for food. We agree strongly with that, and the Outdoor Council has supported subsistence lifestyles consistently. It's the matter and the manner of the priority that has caused us grief for the reasons that I just mentioned. I've often heard that ANCSA requires, did require, or the conference report expressed the expectation that both the state and federal government had an obligation to accommodate subsistence needs of Alaska Natives in particular in that context of the Native Claims Settlement Act. But it didn't say that it had to be on the basis of a rural priority. It didn't say that it had to be for Natives only. It didn't say that it had to be discriminatory, and it didn't say that it did not imply that it need be a no close season, no bag limit, as it turned out to be under ANILCA. So there's a vast difference between adequately accommodating a legitimate need and doing it at the extreme expense of the rest of the population of this, in this case, of the state. Let me comment on a couple myths that seem to survive regardless. They're sort of like those little gophers in the cartoons, you know, where you pop one over here and another one comes up like that, and you hit him, and this guy comes up. And one of them is that the priority under the federal law only comes into play during times of shortage. That simply is not true. That is one of the few points that the Alaska Federation of Natives and the Alaska Outdoor Council agree on with regard to subsistence. But we agree absolutely on that. It's in place at all times. It is not triggered by a shortage. And as a matter of fact, Senator Stevens in 1978 reassured Alaska Natives that any time there is a limitation, that the priority was in place. And there are very few species of fish or game in Alaska for which there are not limitations in the regulations. So that's one myth. To kind of fortify that, and I guess try to provide a glimpse of how things might work in federal court, I'd like to refer to the Bobby case, which was a case in federal court against the state for not adequately providing for subsistence in the case of a fellow who shot a moose near Lime Village in 1989. And it was very shortly before the Alaska Supreme Court threw out the rural priority in state law. And the upshot of it was that he had taken it outside the established state season. It was taken to court by Alaska Legal Services, and it was considered to be by them. They argued that it was not consistent with the customary and traditional requirements in the federal law to which the state was bound at that time, because at that time the state still had the rural priority in law and we were in conformity with federal law. So if you look at that case, you get some idea how it might work if we get back in conformity with federal law and again have federal court oversight. Judge Holland looked at it and said that it was not wrong for this fellow to have done that according to the law, that it was consistent with customary and traditional use, that customary and traditional use amounted to whatever had been done in the collective past by the people in the area using that resource. Well, in the collective past includes a long time. It's kind of the opposite of never, you know, it's forever. And what that meant was that the federal law basically provides for a no close season, no bag limit scenario unless there are two provisions, unless it's counterproductive to the continuation of subsistence or to sound conservation, which sounds pretty good. The difficulty is that it's very easy to prove customary and traditional use because it's based principally on oral history. To prove that there's a conservation risk to a population, the standard of proof is very different. The court demands that a scientific study be done to establish the risk to the population. So that's how federal law worked then. Under Senator Stevens' amendments, that would be modified somewhat. It has some language in there about giving deference to the state agency's decisions, and a deference similar to that given to federal agencies. We have a review of that language, which I'd like to leave with the committee, that says that that language providing for deference to the state actions is, now I can't find it, I'll have to bring it up to you, is little more than a thin sheet of protection. That's the one. From, yes, thank you very much. I guess I left it right behind me. But let me read Mr. Cook's short answer as to the level of protection the deference language in Senator Stevens' amendments provides the state fish and game management. The short answer, the proposed amendment to ANILCA, Section 807, provides no more than a thin sheet of protection from the cold reality of federal court oversight of state fish and game management and penetrating federal judicial scrutiny. I've talked about this with my good friend Charlie Cole quite a bit. We don't seem to be able to reach agreement on it. Thank you very much. But that's not reassuring, in our view. And if you have federal court oversight, you have the potential for decisions like the Bobby case, and that means that the best laid plans of the state fish and game management for the conservation and use and allocation of fish or wildlife could very easily be overturned. In connection with that, to address another item that has come up in your discussion today, and I've also discussed with Mr. Cole, there is a widespread assumption that the federal government can do anything it wants on federal lands, including managed fish and game. And it's based on the property clause, as I understand it. But it's very clear, about 10 years ago, it's very clear, let me complete that thought, to me, and I could be wrong, but I don't think I am, that unless Congress has said that the federal agencies have authority to manage or regulate or control under the property clause, those assets that are federal property, they don't have it. They do not automatically have the authority to manage assets on federal lands unless Congress has specifically provided. Mr. Cole and others refer regularly to the CLEPI case in New Mexico, where the federal government did overrule management actions of the state involved on the basis of the property clause. The difference there was that the Congress had provided that specific authority, and the circumstances are not the same here. As you've already heard, Congress in ANILCA did not give that authority, in this case for the management of fish and game, to the federal governments. And if you look at the committee reports, the history of ANILCA, you will find that progressively the authority of the Secretary of Interior to manage fish and game was reduced and ultimately eliminated. And what was left was the authority to assure that there was a subsistence priority on federal lands, period. There was no authority provided to the Secretary to manage fish and game. That issue, as Rod mentioned, was a question in the Alaska versus Babbitt case. It very badly needed to be addressed. It was, I think, an injustice to Alaskans collectively when the governor dismissed that case with prejudice. So that's my view, and I think it's consistent with the Outdoor Council's view of the question of the authority of the federal government to manage just because it's federal land. That's just simply not the case, regardless of the Babbitt case. One of the contentions we have made, Alaska Outdoor Council has made, is that the myth that if you conform to federal law, you'll get state management back is simply that. It's a myth. If you conform to federal law, you get state management back. If you think about it a little bit, it's really an oxymoron. If you conform to federal law, you get federal law, and that's what you have, that's what you do, that's what you follow, that's what you're required to do. And examples have often been brought up that we have lots of other kinds of federal requirements, and we do. Let me pick just one kind of at random. The federal government requires, in making funds available for the building of highways, that the state build to certain specifications and within certain time frames and so on. If the state does not do that, they don't come in and build a highway. They just withhold the money. In other words, there's not the threat of the federal government taking over the responsibility for building highways if the state doesn't conform to that. In this case, there is the threat of the federal government coming in to take over fish and game management, whether or not they have the legal right, if the state doesn't conform to federal law. So it is very different. In trying to put together a state law that does a job here, one of the really critical issues is how does it relate to the management of fisheries, and does it deal with how do we deal with the federal court decision on Katie John? And I have heard it said that Senator Stevens' amendments address that, and that they will, I think the quote was, wash away or whatever, eliminate the concerns with Katie John. And there's nothing in Senator Stevens' amendments that I can see that does that. There's as a matter of fact, there's seeming acquiescence to the decisions by the courts in Katie John and Alaska versus Babbitt in the findings that are added in the amendments of Senator Stevens to ANILCA. So I don't think that problem has been solved at all. And that's of great concern. Let me just make a couple more comments, if I may. Attorney General Botello said that we need a rural priority because it's the right thing to do. I sent you an opinion piece that I had gotten published in the Anchorage paper, and I said, I can't believe that he's saying that the principal law authority of the state government could be saying that it's the right thing to do when in 1989 the Alaska Supreme Court said, no, it's the wrong thing to do. It's the wrong thing to do because it does discriminate incorrectly among people's interests, and because it is a very crude attempt to meet the benefit, the value provided under the Constitution to all Alaskans of being able to take fish and game for food. The court cited that as one of the important elements of the law that it was attempting to provide for, was the opportunity to take food. And the Alaska Supreme Court said, no, it's not the right thing to do. It does discriminate. And furthermore, it's a terrible fit. There are people in rural Alaska who don't need the food. There are people, but they're qualified under rural. There are people in urban Alaska who do need it, and they can't possibly qualify. They're arbitrarily excluded, and it's going too far to say, well, just move to rural areas. They said, that's going too far. And that's the answer to your question, Representative Berkowitz. It's going too far. It's beyond the bounds of reasonableness in terms of discrimination. The other comment that Attorney General made that I found objectionable and unsubstantiated was that there is a fundamental difference in how rural and urban people gather food. And if we were looking back even as little perhaps as 50 years, I would probably agree with them. But in this day and age and for the foreseeable future, that simply is not the case. And in that regard, I did send to Chairman Green a package of information that reflected that merchandisers recognize perfectly well that what drives the rural economy is cash. And there are literally dozens of opportunities, overtures, flyers, catalogs, what do they call them, bush shoppers or something like that, that go to every rural box holder in Alaska. I checked with one distributor of that kind of advertising based in Anchorage. They mail over 44,000 bush mailers or bush shoppers every month to rural Alaska. And I am just lucky enough to get a copy of every one of them. But it is really interesting. You can call an 800 number. Some places, one outfit outside will pay the postage on all food except frozen foods. Now, they aren't sending those out without some good reason. People in rural Alaska are on the cash economy. There's absolutely no question that the use of fish and game for them is very important to their livelihood, just as it is to mine and to many other urban people. So, in our view, there is not a fundamental difference in how rural and urban people gather food. I guess I'll just conclude there, and if you have questions you'd like to ask, I'd be happy to try to comment on them. I would just add one afterthought, I guess, and that is Representative Croft asked, well, what would you do, sort of, to the Alaska Outdoor Council? Well, referring to the comments about the Hickel Council that attempted to provide an answer, what the Alaska Outdoor Council did at that time, after a great deal of difficulty, and I'll tell you there was some heated debate, was to agree to the idea that it would be okay to have a subsistence priority in state law if it were based on how you live, not where you live. And in that law was, or that proposed law, was a set of criteria which would apply to everyone in Alaska, regardless of where you lived. The same standards would apply. And those standards consisted of a level and variety of use and a degree of effort that would be required to qualify. The difference in treatment of people had to do with what was presumed about whether you qualified. Those in areas that are considered rural were presumed to qualify, but it was a rebuttable presumption. And so if I lived in Lake Minchumina, where I wish I were right now,
so do we.
I would be presumed to qualify. However, somebody could look at how I lived and say, look, things are difficult. Not everyone, we can't afford to have everyone, just because of where they live, continue to qualify. So we're going to look at how you live. I don't have a hunting license, let's say. That's not a very good indication that I'm really dependent on those resources. I have a retirement pay. Have you taken a moose lately? Did you fish? Well, no. You know, well, hit the road. You don't qualify anymore. So it's rebuttable, or that was the proposal. Similarly, in middle-sized communities, 2,500 to 7,000, people would fill out an affidavit and say, I qualify. Again, rebuttable. No further comment unless there's some reason to take exception to it. Those who live in places like Fairbanks or downtown Anchorage would have to provide an affidavit certifying that they did meet those requirements. So the key to that kind of approach was that the same standard applied to all Alaskans if they wished to qualify for subsistence. It was not on the basis of where they lived, it was basis on the basis of how they lived. And by so doing, it was the opinion of the Attorney General, Charlie Cole, and others, that it did not require a constitutional amendment, that it was an acceptable distinction under the Constitution. So that's one way to do it. Now, people said it was too complicated and so on, perhaps so. But considering that most people who would probably care about trying to qualify wouldn't have to do anything except be there, it didn't seem to me that it was very complicated. Anyway, the point of it is that subsistence lifestyles are extremely valuable. You know, the Alaska Supreme Court said that it's a tremendous value. I don't remember the exact words. It runs through every person in the state. And given that fact, and given the interest in it by people who do or wish to pursue those kinds of lifestyles, it seems to us as an organization that it is not proper to restrict it on the basis of an arbitrary and discriminatory standard such as zip code or any other closed class type criterion. And that really is a part of it, the two legs that the Alaska Outdoor Council position stands on. And the other one is, and I'll repeat it, is sound conservation. There has to be something that will work as far as a sound management scheme to conserve the fish and game resources of Alaska. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Dick. I've got a couple of quickies. You were talking about this cash economy. I've asked staff with that information you sent to see. There were some things that struck me that forced to shop with my wife when she's here, as I am, that maybe you can get some of that mail order stuff as cheaply as we can in Anchorage. So I'm having that checked out, but at least to get some comparable prices. If there was a caveat, in your opinion, since you have a good institutional historical memory on this, if there were caveats to ANILCA that were tied to whatever was required of the state to get the caveat, which probably would be something like a constitutional amendment, that the issue in Katie John would be removed from an ANILCA requirement, could you see that there would be some merit then? Because it may be that the state could end up actually overseeing all of Alaska, both land and navigable waters, and we bypass a lot of the stigma that's associated with ANILCA now. You think, A, that that would get us where we want to go, and B, do you think it's even possible?
Chairman Greeden, if I understand correctly, the trade-off would be, or if that's the right word, the agreement.
We understand that, at least, yes.
The agreement would be that if the authority for management of reserved waters, which is a result of the Katie John, were removed, that it would be reasonable to amend the Constitution or make a concession to the requirement of the federal law in order to...
Well, that and management, I mean, there would be two or three issues. Those are the first that come to mind because of what you have said in testimony, but that we would require, as part of the quid pro quo, if you can use that, the attorneys will correct me on that, but that we would amend the Constitution and agree not necessarily to operate it the way the federal government says, but the way, and I'll get to that next question, the way we have seen fit to operate and enhance the stocks, that would be worth a constitutional amendment then, because we could operate the state of Alaska like it should be operated.
Well, Chairman Greene, I guess what I would say is I think it would be part of the answer, but I guess I'd be reluctant to say that would wash away all our troubles. I can think that, for example, and I'd hate to harp on the same old line, but even if that were done, if we still had the provision for federal court oversight of the, let me call it the quality of the state provision for a subsistence priority, then I think we'd still have a real big problem. We might even have a problem in fisheries, and we certainly would have a problem on terrestrial management. So I think we might have to go a little further than that.
Well, that's in the shopping bag now. I don't know how much we'll be able to extract.
It's
a full shopping bag. Finally, I was wondering if, in your institutional memory, do you feel, if we look at harvests since the state took over, the harvest numbers have dramatically increased. Is that because we have better ways to harvest, or do you think that's because of better management providing more critters to harvest?
Are you, Chairman Greene, are you referring to any particular...
Well, generally. I mean, you look at harvest levels, and generally they're up, certainly in fishing.
Well, Chairman Greene, I think that's true of fisheries in particular. In fact, I was just reading something the other day that provided a historic review of harvests in Cook Inlet in particular for quite a long period of time, I think in some species going back to 1893. And there were instances in that historical account where there was a tremendous jump in the take, and I think it had to do with a couple things. One, better management, and two, better equipment. So that was the sum and substance of it. It's also very clear that with regard to salmon runs in general, as I guess almost everyone knows, that the understate management, the salmon populations have recovered, not to overstate it, but almost from the brink of depletion. I wouldn't say extermination, but there's no question that I don't remember the numbers, but it was incredible how small the harvests of salmon were at the time of statehood. And of course, as we all know, the issue of management of those resources in particular, but game as well, was critical to the impetus behind the statehood drive. So I guess it's both. I would add that in a number of other areas, I'm thinking in terms of moose populations in many parts of the state and caribou populations in many parts of the state, that hasn't been the case, that harvests have gone up dramatically. And I can't cite you chapter and verse right now, but there are many areas that have had depressed populations. There are others, of course, like the Western Arctic herd, they're very high. And I don't think anybody has a real good idea of what harvest levels are on it right now.
At least it gives us an impetus to not go back to federal management.
Well, exactly. Ironically, with the Western Arctic herd played in the priority issue in Anilka in 1979 and 80 and 78 because it was characterized as a disaster, a catastrophe, and evidence that federal management was demanded. So 20 years later, the herd is bigger than it's ever been. It must have been that federal management that did it.
Well, the central caribou herd has certainly gone up too. But
right.
Representative Porter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't resist saying, having worked in a fish cannery a couple summers and on a tender when I was a kid, federal management enforcement had a long ways to go from those days, and obviously the state has done a much better job. Dick, I don't mean this to be facetious, but I guess what I need is a feeling for you of how strongly you think that we could prevail in the lawsuit, I guess, that is filed by Ledge Council that would, to some degree, remove the requirement to have a subsistence preference. As I understand your position, that the ultimate goal or the ultimate position that could be supported by the Outdoor Council would be no subsistence preference.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Porter, we have for years, I guess a couple decades probably, that's about how long this has been going on, have said that we don't believe that a subsistence priority is necessary in law to properly accommodate people who rely on the use of fish and game for their livelihood. In other words, who live off the land, who live a subsistence lifestyle.
Would you agree that probably the only way to achieve that, short of a new administration, a new secretary, and perhaps a new Congress, would be through the courts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, that's probably true. Mm-hmm. That's probably true. And frankly, I don't know really how it would turn out.
Well, as I said earlier, and I think you were here, there's no doubt in my mind that if we were able to reach consensus in the legislature on anything, that it would certainly have as a caveat that if the lawsuit prevailed, that whatever was allowed by the lawsuit that was qualified under the statutes would drop off, become null and void. But short of that, the Hammond plan, the system that was in effect prior to McDowell and all that, that provided a basically the kind of thing that I think everybody's talking about, that had the additional caveat of proximity to the resource as one of the qualifications, which was struck by the Kenainsa case, would that be a reasonable middle ground?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Green, that being the proximity clause, is that
the whole shebang that we had in existence previously? I mean, with our definition of customary and traditional, that seems to be a little bit better by the Stevens Amendment in here, and our definition of trade and barter, those kinds of things corrected. But I guess the only concession to what we'd all like to see is that proximity to the resource is something that should be considered when establishing subsistence preferences during shortages.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Porter, I think I may have touched on that already, what it came down to is that after considerable anxious argument, the council concluded that it was much more important to, if there were to be a priority extended to some Alaskans, it was much more important that it be extended on the basis of how they live, not where they live. In other words, the criteria should reflect a commitment, either voluntary or involuntary, to a subsistence lifestyle that demands the reliance and extensive use of fish and game resources to persist in that lifestyle, rather than saying that it depends on where you live or where you live in relation to the resource. Based partly on the McDowell case, partly on what our reading of the Constitution was, partly on, I guess you could say, a collective judgment of what it was that people seemed to be wanting to get at, it reflected better, a priority based on how you live, reflected better the need, if there's going to be a priority, than anything else. And I would add that the Alaska Supreme Court also said that a priority that was based on individual criteria that related to a person's lifestyle would be less invasive of the common use provision of the Alaska Constitution, as opposed to a geographic distinction.
Sure, let me just try it one more way.
All right.
I don't disagree with the thing you've said. I guess what I'm trying to relate is that it's my opinion at this point that if we don't come forth with something that in some way we can say meets the intent of a local preference, and I'll take rural out of there, I think we could do that. But something that we could say met that, we fail.
On that point,
we have all sorts of success here and satisfy ourselves. It doesn't fly at the federal level, and we get the takeover. So I guess what I'm asking you is, if with that assumption, which you don't have to make, but it's for academic exercise, what, in your view, would be the least offensive provision that would seem to try to meet that rural preference?
Well, I appreciate your question, Mr. Chairman. I'll take a shot at it just from my own perspective. And that is, and I have had many discussions with a lot of different people about this kind of idea. How do you get there? And I think that if you have to incorporate some recognition of place, I'll just put it that way, that if the priority were related to a place where it was very clear that, going back to the origin of this argument over subsistence, people relied on fish and game for food. That's where this whole thing started before it blew off into economics and culture and everything else. It was a basic issue about the opportunity to get food. So if it was a place that clearly the majority of people were reliant on fish and game for their food, and there may be other conditions that would help characterize that and that it was a, had few alternatives, you know, then, you know, that sort of thing. And really what that does, I mean, that idea to me kind of incorporates what I was stressing before, is that you're talking about not so much place as lifestyle. And I can tell you from personal experience that there are a few places, very few, Tolita being one of them, where there's almost nobody there now, but for many years there were very, very few alternatives. But it was one of the last places in Alaska where people were really living off the land. And there were several reasons for that. They had no regular mail service, they had no regular communication, they had nothing. But, you know, times have changed.
Thank you.
On that point, Representative Croft?
So in your opinion, there would be very few of those bona fide places left?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft, that's correct.
So even under what Representative Porter was talking about, we just wouldn't have that many places to define as. And I guess the reason that went on this point, he was talking about a local preference, and I wanted to understand why that local proximity preference doesn't make some sense. If we take your criteria and analyze everybody across the state and say, find out who is truly dependent, not for 100%, but for a substantial amount on fish and game resources, and we find somebody in Wrangell who relies on the fisheries there for their subsistence, and there's somebody in Kotzebue who relies on the game resources there for their resources, why does it make any sense to have that Wrangell person have a subsistence right for the Kotzebue herd and vice versa? Why wouldn't it make more sense to say, on those criteria, you have only a right to the things that you have customarily and traditionally used, and we're going to do it by area rather than somebody having some what strikes me as an odd right to fly 3,000 miles to subsist? So why doesn't, in that context, locale make a lot of sense as a criteria?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Croft, I think in that sense it does. If, however, in that same context, the law operated as the federal law presently does, which is that all other uses must be eliminated before customary and traditional uses can be restricted beyond what has been customary and traditional, then it doesn't make very much sense. Because what that says, and that's another thing we agree with AFN on, it's amazing how many things we agree on.
Finding more and more.
Yeah, right. But what that means is that until you've assured that the subsistence user or those subsistence users in Wrangell that they're customary and traditional, not their needs necessarily, but their customary and traditional uses, opportunities have been met, other people may not be allowed to either hunt or fish. So, you know, on the one side, it has merit, and there's no sense in someone flying across the state to hunt for subsistence, as far as I know. Although, you know, there are people in the bush who have airplanes who will argue that they routinely use them as a tool in their subsistence gathering, and they certainly do to the same, in the same fashion as other people use four-wheelers and snow machines and so on. And they've been doing it a lot longer, which is kind of ironic.
Thank you, Mr.
But,
just a real quick one, if I could. I was interested in your statement that the subsistence preference by ANILCA right now is a subsistence preference regardless of shortage. I don't disagree with that, but would we not, do you think, from your experience, be on safe ground trying to meet their conditions by saying that it would only be in our law at a time of shortage, given that there is an adequate abundance for people's needs, sans a shortage?
I'm not sure I got your point, Representative Porter. I'm sorry.
I think you were concerned that ANILCA would provide a subsistence preference on public lands
Yes.
Regardless of shortage.
Mr. Chairman. I'd like to turn it around and put it this way, that ANILCA demands a priority.